Please welcome Charles Falco.
Thank you very much. We can put that back. Well, thank you all for coming. He introduced me saying I worked at Argonne, and therefore I'm familiar with the area. I left here 25 years ago. The area has changed completely. But I was familiar with the area 25 years ago. As you'll see, I think this may be one of the only physics lectures you'll ever hear in your life where it's appropriate to introduce it with the sound of trumpets. So this work is done in collaboration with David Hockney, about whom I will tell you a little bit more in a few minutes. And in various acknowledgments, David Graves and Richard Schmidt are David Hockney's assistants in London and in Hollywood, where he has studios in both places. Well, I'll tell you a little bit more about Lawrence Weschler in a minute also. Martin Kemp was an art historian who helped us some early ideas in learning about the history of art at the time. And Jose Sassian is a colleague of mine in the College of Optical Sciences at Arizona who did some ray tracing calculations very early on that saved me a lot of effort. I'm not going to show you any of those calculations today, but I'm grateful for that. And I'll tell you about the others in a minute as we go. So an ambitious program for the afternoon. I'm going to teach you a lot. Those of you who know about optics, in fact, you may know too much. So I'm going to have to tell you, you may think optics need to be much more perfect than they need to be in order to make use of them. So I'm going to teach you how good optics really has to be in order to do the things that I'm showing you that they were useful for, and give you some general background and tell you about what they knew 600 years ago, tell you about the optics you need to know to understand the evidence, spend the bulk of my lecture showing you just a very small selection of the scientific evidence that we've collected that optics were used to create portions of images. David Hockney. Those of you who are not familiar with him, just one second just to teach you about him. Two respected dictionaries of art and artists, most critically acclaimed British artist of his generation. Posterity may well acclaim him the greatest of modern portraitists. Okay, so it doesn't matter whether he's the greatest or 10th greatest. If there were a Nobel Prize in art, he would be a candidate for it. So he's a world-class artist, and it was his eye as an artist that allowed him to see certain features in paintings that led him to question things. And I'll show you the answers that resulted from that kind of questioning. I acknowledged Lawrence Weschler. Turns out that, as my introduction said, I was a co-curator of The Art of the Motorcycle. My fellow co-curator, Alton Guilfoyle, another acknowledgement, when this article appeared in The New Yorker, January of 2000, called me in Tucson and said, Falco, I don't care what you're doing. Go by The New Yorker, read this article, and call me back. Well, fortunately, New Yorker takes a couple days to get to Tucson. So the story was delayed for like 2 or 3 days, and then it started up again when I read the article. And what it explained was David Hockney had been sort of looking at certain paintings, some of which I'll show you today, and he thought, you know, really by eyeball alone, and we'll introduce two concepts. Eyeball means just our classic way of thinking of a painter, just kind of looking and painting. By eyeball alone, I don't see how a painter could have done that. Now, given David Hockney's own skill level, for him to say, I don't think a painter could have done that without some kind of aid, sets a standard. I mean, he understands what his own limitations are, perfectly willing to accept that there are some painters that can paint better than him, but not an order of magnitude better. And so this article, which in fact Lawrence Weschler subsequently wrote about, said brought him more letters than any other article he'd ever written, some quite upset by what we've said. Result, I've got a stalker out of this whole thing, and I've gotten, I give a great after-dinner talk of, I call the Twilight Zone, of some of the really interesting things, most of which are non-threatening, that have come out of this. And one of the ironies in life, now, all of you guys are in high-energy physics, in condensed matter physics, and you may have had to take a class in this back in graduate school, the classic textbook you would have used was by Cattell. So my vision, and I don't know what the analogous classic high-energy physics textbook is, but my vision, if you would have asked me years ago in graduate school, if I could, in the 97th edition of Cattell, if you turned to the index and you found, I looked under Falco, and you found the Falco effect on page 27, and it said, you know, Charles Falco measured something, and here's the curve, I would have been, that's great, you know, what more could you want? Well, the European Science Foundation organized a conference around us, and I've got a thesis named after me, in an area which I've done no studies in whatsoever. So there are sort of morals to a lot of these things that have happened. If you asked a variety of scholars in a variety of disciplines, a classic, go to the faculty club at the University of Chicago at lunch, and you talk to people that are from art history, from biology, from architecture, from every discipline, and you ask them, would you agree that optical instruments first appeared around 1600 with the invention of the telescope by Galileo? Most people would agree. Some people that were very knowledgeable would say, well, actually, we think Galileo, we know he stole the idea for the telescope from a Dutch physicist from a couple of years earlier, but I won't argue with the 1600. That's a good date. If you want to focus an image onto a CCD array, a piece of photographic film, or a canvas, it requires a lens. Mirrors only reflect images. Most people, incorrectly, would agree with that, and Renaissance masters produce their work by just sheer genius alone. Well, if what I'm going to show you today is correct, all of these statements are wrong. And they're not just wrong on a technicality. They're fundamentally wrong. So the evidence I'm going to show you really goes to the base level of a liberal arts education. So you have to pay attention. Because this, when you do something that really changes ways of thinking, you got to make sure that we've done this correctly. Now, if you looked at the history of art and how artists have represented the human form in two dimensions, well, very flat. Well, we can have two theories for this. Either Egyptians were flat, or the painters couldn't figure out how to represent them in three dimensions. We come up still very flat, unlifelike. We come to Van Eyck. If this man walked in the room right now, we would have no trouble whatsoever recognizing him. It's photographic level realism. How did that happen? And it's not like people hadn't noticed this before. You know, people, art historians, have noticed this and puzzled over it for years. What they didn't know is a very important clue is right there in front of the painting. Spectacles. A typical pair of reading glasses that people, sort of the average age of this audience, would buy are one and a half, two diopter. A one diopter reading glass you would buy at the drugstore for $5 has a focal length of 1 meter. Two diopters is half a meter. It's the reciprocal of it. When we calculate the places where we can calculate the focal lengths of lenses that were used, they're about 1.5 diopter reading glasses strength. I honestly have had a well-respected art historian tell me when I found this, when we first went into this, art historians told us there were no lenses at the time. Well, okay, we'll believe that. And we went forward, found these spectacles. Told this respected art historian. He said, well, sure, they had spectacles, but they didn't have lenses. So we are failing our non-science majors in teaching them certain things. Now, to show you spectacles can reflect something, and to show you a property of images, you have to remember, images, when projected, are upside down. Here's my secretary holding a pair of spectacles I bought from the drugstore. And she's focused. I'm on the 10th floor, is where my lab is. And so she's focusing the image of, there you can see the directly reflected image in the glasses. And you can see we're looking down on the roof, of the white roof of the building. There's the building upside down. There's the Rincon Mountains in the background in Tucson. Perfectly fine image, more than enough resolution for Van Eyck to have used to produce every one of his paintings. And it's right there. So let's look at trying to represent three-dimensional forms or geometrical objects in three dimensions into two dimensions in proper perspective. Well, I think you can tell just by glancing that that's not a very good perspective. And if I do fit a perfect perspective-corrected hexagon, it doesn't fit very well. Well, let's look at this chandelier. This is the Van Eyck chandelier from the Arnold Feeney marriage, a painting about which I'm going to tell you more. I've blown this up. I don't know how wide this screen is. It looks like 15 feet wide or so. Look at the level of detail of this chandelier. Look at how fine the detail is. Now, to life size, if you could go to the British Museum and find that chandelier and find that feature of the chandelier. This is it, life size. I've taken an image that's this size. I've blown it up to where it's 15 feet across, and it maintains its resolution and its incredible level of detail. How did Van Eyck do that? That's incredible. In terms of the painting itself, the width of that candle holder, the widest point is 5.2 millimeters. Someone did a movie for very different reasons. They're looking at something different. And they tried to fit a perfect hexagonal chandelier to the painting. And so let's see if we fit that perfect hexagon. Notice, it doesn't fit perfectly. It fits just merely incredibly well. You can see by here that, kind of worst case, we're off by 2 or 3 millimeters. An object that is reproduced on a painting, but again, this size, and the worst case, you make errors by a couple of millimeters, could be a couple possible reasons for that. One is he tried to draw it in perfect perspective, but in fact, the laws of perspective had not been discovered yet. So either this is, you know, proof that Van Eyck discovered the laws of geometrical perspective. The other is, when you learn perspective, if you actually have studied it, you've been taught a dumbed-down version, a version that only applies to perfectly symmetric object. A real chandelier, and I calculate from features on the chandelier, that was roughly 1 meter across. It's this size. There's arms that are facing forward, this way, backwards, and weighs about 40 pounds, and it can't be made perfectly. And I'll show you the deviations from this chandelier from perfection are just what you'd expect for a handmade object. And we'll come to that. What was known about optics at the time? Well, if you would have asked me, I don't know, 5 years ago, what were going on during medieval times or the Dark Ages, I would have told you, I don't know, the Cro-Magnons were fighting the Neanderthals, and who knows what was going on. Turns out that the medieval time was a period of intense intellectual activity. There are 65 treatises on optics that were published in this period between 1000 and the time of Van Eyck, one every 7 years. There aren't that many new textbooks of geometrical optics published that frequently today. So people were trying to understand optics very much so. Unfortunately, the people back there were not very intelligent. They couldn't write in English. So, and the other problem we have is that very few of these texts have been translated into any modern European language. And it's not just simply, if you've used Google and you've come across a foreign language page and you hit translate it for me, you know what kind of does sometimes a job that it's useful, but it doesn't do an incredibly good job. The problem with having someone translate something from Latin into English here, many of the terms that we take for granted today are ambiguous. Latin did not have words for concave mirror, convex mirror, glass that's in a window. The word that was used for every one of those objects was glass. And so it's up to the translator to understand geometrical optics enough to know how to translate the passages. And so it's a very difficult prospect. But some that have been translated talk about how to grind the appropriate spherical mirrors from clear iron, how to polish it. So it was understood how to make the mirrors. In fact, I made a mirror. I can show you how to make a mirror in 30 minutes out of metal that has better resolution than Van Eyck needed for any of his work. This is my backyard. There's saguaro cactuses. If we blow this up, we can see how wide the hose is, how wide the wrought iron fence is at that point. Van Eyck's mirror, the resolution on any of the paintings he made, could have been 3 times worse than this and still have worked. Now, if you're used to thinking in terms of the Hubble Space Telescope, the resolution of it is 2,000 times better. It's way better. So those of us who ever were tempted to grind a telescope in high school, and you read all the books about grinding telescopes, you know how incredibly careful you had to be to grind things to quarter wave of light and stuff. You learn too much. You can get by with much worse. Well, how much worse? I bought this ladle from a wholesale restaurant supply company in Tucson. It's stamped out of stainless steel, made in Korea, spot welded, and has holes punched in it. Here's a photograph of the scene seen outside the window, so you can see what we're going to project. Top of the building, we'll project an image with that ladle. Multiple focal lengths. Now, it's not the world's greatest image, but it's certainly not the world's greatest mirror. So the fact is, you can get by with very bad technology and project images that are recognizable. One of the good features about working in a collaboration with someone as famous as David Hockney is people like this professor of English, Peter Schroeder, contacted me. Believe me, there are downsides to having people be able to find your address so easily. He said, are you aware of the discussion of the mirrors in The Romance of the Rose? Well, I confess, I'd never heard of The Romance of the Rose, but the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Tucson carried two copies on the shelf. Now, if you're familiar with publishing, you know copies of books that don't sell go out of print almost immediately. So that tells us that it's widely read today. And if you look it up, you'll find it in courses, of countless humanity courses, as part of the required reading. In the preface to this translation, the translator tells us that in the 13th century, prior to Van Eyck, it was the most widely read book in the French language. Van Eyck worked for the court of Burgundy, so presumably he spoke French. There are four pages, highlighted in white, where mirrors are discussed. And you're not supposed to be able to read this. I'm just going to blow up a few things. Alhazen wrote the Book of Optics. Student will be able to discover the causes and strengths of mirrors that have wonderful powers. Alhazen is an Isaac Newton-level scientist. He was an Arab scientist, born in Basra, died in Cairo, and he wrote books on many scientific topics, including optics. And just prior to The Romance of the Rose, his book on optics was translated into Latin. And another place it says that he's not going to take the trouble to clarify the shapes of mirrors. He's not going to tell us convex, concave, flat, I'm not going to tell you how rays are reflected or describe their angles. I'm not an expert in medieval French epic poetry, but this seems like awfully technical language to me to be using. Everything is written elsewhere in a book. He's already told us where the book is. Another passage here, certain mirrors, if you put a large bulky object in front of them, the mountains between France and Sardinia is a province in the Pyrenees next to Andorra, so he's talking about the Pyrenees Mountains, will seem small. Well, he doesn't have to tell us as scientists that he's talking about convex mirrors, because we know if you have a security mirror, I think I even saw one here for as you drive around the site to make sure you don't run into somebody coming around the corner, to widen your angle of view. It makes objects small. And some mirrors even make phantoms appear quite alive outside the mirror, either in air or in water in the air. He wasn't trying to rhyme in French. The optical properties of water and air were of great interest to the philosophers of the time. A solid, light doesn't go through. Air, light goes forever through. Water's in between. It has some of the properties of a solid, some of the properties of being transparent. Before we'd been told about The Romance of the Rose, the BBC filmed us, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a 21st century artist describing a projected image. Here's a cabbage. It's projected. It's hanging upside down because the projected image is upside down, and David Hockney was trying to reproduce a particular Cotan painting, and he's going to describe this, and I want you to compare his words to those in The Romance of the Rose.
And I realized this is a color movie. It moves. I mean, there it is. It's spinning. It's quite beautiful. Of course, it's upside down. The string's coming from the bottom. And I then realized, my God, this is a movie in color. They must have seen it 600 years ago.
Well, David's wrong. They saw it 700 years ago. So what I've shown you to this point is that they had the technology to make the mirrors. They understood how to project images. I haven't still shown you... They did use them. So the rest of my lecture, I have to show you that they did do that. Excuse me. My asthma is bothering me. I'm sorry. I'm going to keep coughing. So I've got to tell you the properties of optics that you're going to need to use to understand the evidence I'm going to show you for the bulk of my lecture. So I'm going to show you the optics you need to know, and I swear to you I'm not going to show you any optics you don't need to know. So I'm not going to sneak any extra optics in on you. So pay attention to this part of my talk. This is a dark room, and you know it's late afternoon. This is the time you might want to be taking a nap. This is the time not to take the nap. So one feature, go to some train track here in Illinois, and you stand out in the middle of the train tracks. You go, well, of course, all the train tracks, we know they're parallel. We know they're a certain distance apart, but they seem to come to a point. Well, we know they don't, and this is one of the properties of geometrical optics. They come to a point. What we don't learn in just standard understanding superficial geometry is this only works for a perfect set of mathematically perfect parallel lines. Any deviations, we can see. Here are these telephone poles, but we can see the deviations. So we're going to look for deviations from these kinds of perspective. In this particular painting, after the laws of perspective were discovered, well, things are too good to be true. Here it's pretty clear he used the laws of geometry, he understood the laws of geometry, to construct the painting. He didn't project the image of a city. No city could have been that perfect. So we can eliminate this as evidence that optics was used for that. If we... excuse me. I'm above you. I'm looking down on you. So my vantage point as a camera is looking down. There's a horizon line. All these vanishing lines come to points on the horizon line. If I were below, they would the vanishing line would be below. Here's a chandelier. I draw very accurately the vanishing lines, and they don't come to these well-defined vanishing points that we were taught they should have come to. Well, something's wrong. Well, what's wrong is the description that we've been given. Because I can guarantee you this is an optical projection. I took that photograph myself with my own digital camera. And the problem you have, what's causing the problem is if we have two arms like this, and I move this one forward by an eighth of an inch, you can't see that. But when you extrapolate a couple points this far away, it misses completely because we're extrapolating by so far. Science has to be reproducible. Different chandelier, different Home Depot. Both on Broadway Boulevard in Tucson. So I saw maybe need to do one more chandelier in a different store. So what we understand about the perfect laws of perspective, we're going to have to kind of throw out because they're oversimplified. Another thing is if you visited my laboratory and you didn't know how tall David Hockney was, you could look up in an almanac. We're going to make an estimate. That's the average height of a European male. That tells us the horizontal distance across the scene. At the depth at which he's standing, well, everyone knows the molecular beam epitaxy console is 2 meters, so we don't have to look that up. So we make an estimate. It tells us he used a 22-millimeter focal length lens to take this photograph. My technician used a 24-millimeter focal length lens to take the photograph. So within the uncertainties of our estimate, that's perfect agreement. But it has to be because we're talking about the laws of optics. A one-second movie clip. Here's Arnold. He's going to look into the scene. Now, aside from the focus changing, what else changed? Well, you probably didn't notice, if I bring Arnold back, here's some highlights on the trailer. We know how tall Arnold's head is because we can look that up. Excuse me. There's his head. There's the size of the film. So we know the magnification, 0.06. Not very large. Remember, most paintings... portraits you see from the period, person's head is about this size, comparable to life size, not life size. Back of trailer, highlights. Turn partway in, focus partway in, the highlights moved. All the way in, the highlights move more. So either in causing the camera to refocus, we've shrunk the trailer, or we've discovered a property of optics. And one property is if I focus on someone in the front of the room and I change my mind, I want to focus my lens on the exit sign in the back of the room. Counterintuitively, I have to pull the lens toward me to refocus. In doing so, I change the magnification. Normally, we deal with very small magnifications. This effect is so small. You've seen this countless times in movies, and I'll bet you very few, if any of you, ever noticed it before. It's an 8% effect, though, because you're not used to it, and you've never noticed it, and now you're not going to be able to not notice it from now on. If this effect were much larger, if the magnification was much larger, the effect would be larger. And so we have these equations that we're going to use. So refocusing further into a scene reduces the magnification. Another scene. You can see the mountains are a little bit out of focus, but we're focused on Tom Cruise's head.
If I let you know where I'm going.
We zoom in. Now the mountains are completely out of focus. So another optical property. Again, different film, but we know how tall the film frame was. Estimate how tall Tom's head was. Magnification, the same as we had for Arnold. When we refocus in, we've increased the magnification by a factor of 3, but we've decreased the depth of field by a huge amount. So increasing the magnification decreases the depth of field, the amount of the scene that's in focus. And we've got equations for it. And if I increase the magnification to nearly a life-size portrait, the depth of field would decrease by over a factor of 100. It's a nonlinear effect. This causes painters a hard time. So here's how we propose these guys use. I'm going to hope I don't lose my voice before this is all over. One of David's friends is dressed up looking like a Van Eyck figure, Cardinal Albergati. His image is reflected in focus by this concave mirror onto the wall, upside down, a live movie. The artist captures some of the features that he needs to have to create the portrait, takes it down, and now doesn't have to work from optics anymore. He's already captured an optical-based image, and he fills in the rest of the details by eyeball alone, has this. Now, if he wants to make this into a painting, he can add color. Now, I'm going to show you a 30-second clip of this actually happening. Here's David. Watch this guy's eye. He'll blink. It's a movie. It's in color. And here, actually, David is filling in more details than he actually would need. To get the optical-based image, takes it down, works from life, eyeball alone, to produce the painting. And it's done. Well, now, the cardinal was sitting outside in the sunlight, so he can, by eyeball, you know, put him outside. You can add that. Or you can just because he was outside, the artist is not constrained to put the subject outside. You can put him inside. Or you can put him with his buddies. So, these are collages. I'm going to show you the evidence that certain features within certain paintings are optically based. Other features are not optically based. It's more complicated than that. These are not photographs. So it's harder to analyze. It's harder to extract the information. Here in the Arnolfini marriage, the little dog. In fact, if we magnify him, one of my colleagues raises dogs, raises these are Bichon as the breed. He assures me this little dog runs around so much that if you have your shutter set anything slower than a 500th of a second, the dog's a blur. So this tells us that Van Eyck either convinced the Arnolfinis to let him kill their dog and stuff it, or he had the skill to paint the dog without doing that. So, in fact, this is pretty good indirect evidence that Van Eyck had superb technical skills. The question of whether Van Eyck needed to use optics, and if he used optics, those are two separate questions. These may have been a total figment of Van Eyck's imagination. Those shoes may never have even existed in reality. He had put them there for some kind of symbolic reason or to balance the composition. But where optics would have been useful is that chandelier, that amazing chandelier. But again, remember, even though Van Eyck may have seen this image projected in front of him upside down, he saw this. Optics don't make marks. The photographic film makes a mark, but optics don't make marks. You've got an image in front of you. You're free to do whatever you want. So even if he saw this, this is what he painted. The artist's mind enters into things. So these are not photographs. So if you analyze this painting, and if you only looked at this feature, you would decide this isn't based on optics. Well, you've made a mistake. You've looked at the wrong thing. You have to look at the right features. Now, one thing, somebody's bumping our projector. Here's the Arnolfini marriage. The perspective of this painting, of the mirror, that's a round mirror. Remember, if we're looking up from below, the mirror would be elliptical. we can tell that the vantage point of the artist was about here. So roughly, the artist was looking at the thing from that level. Let me magnify the center section of that painting, saying that roughly speaking, the artist was looking at it from this level.
Is the man in blue Van Eyck, and the curtain behind him his camera obscura with a bright object, his mirror lens?
This is exactly where the mirror would have to be if he used a camera obscura with a concave mirror. Doesn't prove that's what it is, but it's just in the right spot. So this is like an Alfred Hitchcock movie, I believe, that for 600 years, Van Eyck's been hiding in there, and he's hiding his actual experimental apparatus they used, and now we figured out what it was. So I'm going to show you now the evidence that optics were used in paintings. This one, the first example I'm going to show you, was 75 years before Galileo. 75 years before presumably optics even could have been used, whether or not they were, and then 175 years before. When I first visited David Hockney's studio, right after I got started, this, a few weeks after I first read this article, his studio is built on a former tennis court. So it gives you an idea of the scale. From here to here is the length of a tennis court. And let me magnify the center section. He had organized paintings that looked to him optical chronologically. He'd made color photocopies, organized them chronologically, paintings from Northern Europe on the upper wall, Southern Europe on the lower wall. This is exactly how a scientist would, of course, try to organize data to try to figure out where things happened. Did it happen here? Did it happen later there? What goes on? And one painting really caught my eye that first day, and it's this Lorenzo Lotto painting. I'm going to show you this in more detail, but the first feature I want you to notice is it kind of goes out of focus here, and I'll magnify that in a second, but I want you to remember the woman, because the woman is my ruler. That wasn't a gender-based statement. That was a scientific statement. Here is that center section. We can try correcting for perspective. Well, first, we notice it goes out of focus in the back. The human eye doesn't naturally see part of a scene in focus, part of a scene out of focus. This is not an aging question of needing reading glasses. See the gentleman in the front row in focus. I see the exit sign in focus. My brain hasn't bothered telling me that in going between him and the exit sign, it's caused the muscles in my pupils to contract, to change the focal length, to refocus. So I see the entire scene. I see everybody in focus. My brain always sees it in focus. Only if you've projected an image or seen a projected image or seen a photograph have you ever seen part of a scene out of focus. This is a little bit difficult for us in the 21st century to get our brains around because we've all been exposed to billions of photographs by this point in our life. You have to put yourself back before anybody had ever seen a projected image. So going out of focus, set of vanishing lines in the front, different set in the back. And as I'll show you, there's a third set. If I try to correct for perspective, I can't. You can clearly see that's not a good hexagon or octagon. So I can't do that. If I put that back in, goes out of focus, I don't know, somewhere in here. Let me look at a completely different part of the painting. At the same depth into the painting where the central feature goes out of focus. Looks pretty good. But if we analyze a little more carefully, set of vanishing lines at the front, set in the back, and they differ by 3 degrees. I won't talk about that. I'm going to reproduce this experiment. Unlike Fermilab employees, university professors are not paid nearly as highly, so I can't afford to buy a 15th century Turkish carpet. So I've had to use this bedspread. And so I've put my camera on a tripod, focused on the front of the bedspread where it goes over the front of the bed, taking a photograph. And now what I'm going to do is simply refocus further into the scene. I'm not going to move the camera at all, but I'm going to have to move the lens a little bit closer to the camera to refocus there. And then paste together the top half of this photograph with the bottom half of that photograph. You can see it's starting to go out of focus, and then it gets sharp again. Well, it looks pretty good, except again, we analyze that ruler. It's no longer a straight line. Deviates by 3.5 degrees. This is not a coincidence. It has to be because we're dealing with optics. Well, since I've got an octagonal pattern, I should be able to fit a perspective-corrected octagon to it. So I'll make an octagon, put a size on it, correct for perspective, make it in color, take away the ruler, put it in color, and I'll lay it on top of the octagon. Well, I mean, maybe if I were a high energy experimentalist, I would say I've discovered the Higgs boson because it fits so well. But then somebody else would say, no, it doesn't fit at all back here. So what we're talking about at lunch, I suppose this, we'd split into two groups at this point, publish two different papers. But remember that this is not what Lotta would have seen if he projected an image at near life size with a simple lens of the time. It would have, and I've had to simulate this with Photoshop. We've got a kind of fuzzy image in front, but usable, but it gets way too fuzzy. It's several depths of field into the photograph, into the painting too far. Well, this is what we've got. Let's make use of it. We'll fill in the details we can here, and then refocus the lens further back. I have to pull the lens toward me. Magnification decreases. Whoa, look at that. Fill that in and do it one more time. And fill that in. And now I have something that fits with amazing accuracy. Not perfect, but again, this is not a perfect octagonal pattern. It's a real Turkish rug. I could calculate something from this if only I had a ruler. And I do. The woman, the distance across her shoulders in the painting is 10 inches. In real life, the distance across a woman's shoulders is 18 inches. I know this because I have a wife and two daughters, and I measured the three of them. So I have three data points. In the land of the dataless, the man with three data points is king. So this is more data points than existed in the entire discipline of art history before. So that gives me the magnification of the painting of 0.56. I have this nice regular triangular pattern, and coincidentally, it works out that on a scaled print, the distance from there to there is 2 centimeters, a nice round number. It goes out of focus somewhere in here. I know what that is in real units of centimeters, so I can calculate real focal lengths and properties of lenses. So this is the version for scientists. I have this equation. I've got the magnification, depth of field. Geometrical optics gives me two equations that tell me focal length, the distance from the lens to the subject, and the distance from the lens to the image. The magnification. So in the front of the painting, magnification, depth of field, three separate regions, I've got 6 equations, but 7 unknowns. Yeah, see, you guys are different. And when I give public lectures, this is the point in the audience where everybody's looking stunned. What does this mean?
This is it. That moment they told us about in high school, where one day algebra would save our lives.
So we remember, 6 equations, 7 unknowns, I have to make one assumption, and everything follows from it. I'm going to assume the distance from my lens to my carpet was about 4 feet. And I've got error bars and stuff. It really can't be much bigger than that. It doesn't make sense. It can't be much smaller than that. But I have error bars on this. That gives me all the other distances, the magnification, which I said has to change. So geometrical optics dictates that if Lotto used a lens to create this image, there have to be 3 sets of magnifications. There have to be 3 regions in here. And from my fit, the distance, when I first focused on the front of the carpet, that's my distance. From this first kink here to there is D1. When I refocus, the distance decreased to here because I pulled the lens toward me. That distance changed by 13.1%. I calculate from my six equations and 7 unknowns, I calculate it should have decreased by 12.6%. It agrees to a 0.5% accuracy. And the second place where it changes by 13.3%. I calculate 13.5%. A different change, a different calculation, but again agrees to 0.5%. So did Lotto use a lens? Well, of course he used a lens. I mean, there's no other way this coincidence could have happened. But I realized sort of I had problems with general audiences understanding this, so I put this quote in. This Alan Winter has appeared at several conferences with me, that we're not saying that optics is the only way to get perspective right. We're saying optics is the only way to get perspective wrong, in exactly the ways these artists got perspective wrong. If they got perspective perfectly correct, I can't tell you whether or not optics was used. If they got it wrong and they made certain kinds of mistakes, it's only under those circumstances that I can show you that optics were used. And in light of the time, I'll just kind of flip through these immediately. So we got all sorts of evidence from this painting. We call this our Rosetta Stone. There's so much information in this painting to allow us to calculate the focal length, the diameter of the lens, this 62-centimeter focal length. Remember, a diopter is a meter. So two diopter reading glasses would be 50 centimeters. This is like 1.75 diopter. In fact, it's the reading glasses I use now, roughly. Yes? I'm assuming something about the opening of the lens. You mean to give me the depth of field of the lens? In fact, I'm not assuming anything about the opening of the lens. I calculate that in, I'm not going to show you today because I don't have the time, but that's something I can calculate, is the diameter of the lens. From the depth of field, the measured depth of field, you know, how far, how many repeat distances go back, tells me a depth of field in centimeters, and then from another equation of geometrical optics, lets me calculate the diameter of the lens, and it turns out it's, you know, about an inch. It's a very small, nondescript object. Second, this is the oldest painting that we're aware of that I can find optical evidence that that lenses were used. This painting exists in New York in the Metropolitan Museum in the Cloisters and sort of on the upper tip of Manhattan. And you can go and you can see what I'm about to show you with your own eyes. It's a big enough effect you can see it. I'm not going to show you this today for lack of time. I'm going to show you the feature here. The chair behind Joseph's head, nice rectangular pattern. There's, you know, ways you can make a lattice work having this nice straight line pattern. You can just put your ruler down and draw straight lines. That's a way to get it. There's various ways you can get straight lines. I'll show you that's not what he's got. Let's try to see if optics were used. I'll take a perfect grid, at least as perfect as I can draw. I'll correct for perspective, and I'll lay it on top of that lattice work and see how well it fits. But it doesn't fit at all. I mean, I can't fit it anywhere. But then I realize, well, let's focus on the front. If I focus on the front, it fits really well. Not perfectly. I mean, off by 2 millimeters. A handmade 14th century wooden chair is not going to be better than 2 millimeters to begin with. But things go bad here. Well, let me refocus and fit and refocus again. Three patterns that fit, and again, from this, from the magnification, do I want to show you this? I meant to take this out. We can skip over this. I mean, just more technical stuff. The angles I can extract from this. I want to go a little bit faster so I don't lose my voice. I calculate from this the diameter of the lens that Campani used was about an inch. Lorenzo Lotto was about an inch. Focal lengths are both comparable. And the remarkable or not remarkable thing about this is everywhere where I can extract quantitative values, different artists, different periods of time, they're all consistent. It's not like I calculate a lens this big for one painter and a lens this big for another painter. Always where I can extract quantitative information, it comes out with reasonable values. Yes? Would I get the same effect if I had a pinhole? And the answer is no, because a pinhole has, not quite true, infinite depth of field. You don't refocus it. If I have a pinhole, it makes the image very dim, but I get everybody in focus. The reason why I get these effects are I have to move my lens. And I calculate the size of the lens. So, no, you don't get the same effect with a pinhole. Both paintings are very well focused. Okay, let me answer a question that you are almost formulating to ask. Lorenzo Lotto saw the back of his carpet in focus after he refocused the second time, but yet he painted it out of focus. Why did he do that if he saw it in focus? And the reason is because it's a geometrical pattern. When you change the magnification, the pattern changes, and these nice regular triangular patterns don't match in the center anymore. It's like now trying to thread a quarter 20 nut on a quarter 28 bolt. It just won't work. And so right in the center of your vision, the place where it's most obvious, it doesn't match up. This is going down where this is kind of also going down. He solved that problem by painting it out of focus. And I'll just sort of toss in something else. He used that same composition 25 years later. Nobody here is young enough to understand this. Well, some of you might understand this statement. 25 years later, he used the same composition, husband, wife, complex tablecloth, right where the tablecloth would have gone out of focus had he used a lens. He put a great big silver platter. And the expression is, age and treachery always wins over youth and enthusiasm. Refocusing twice, mentioning everything, this was a lot of hard work. And I can imagine the guy 25 years older, 25 years wiser, thinking, oh, I don't want to go through that again. And he solved the problem by putting a big silver platter. So different kind of optical evidence now. Here is a three-dimensional object. As I said, it's a meter across. I have a candle on there. Luckily, the properties of candles are fairly independent of other parameters, because what gives rise to the candle flame is wax is being wicked up a wick, and it burns. So you don't get candle flames that are this tall. You don't get candle flames that are that tall. So we can get some estimates on the size of the candle flame just because wax is wax, no matter what kind of wax it is. And that determines how fast the wax flows is how big the candle can get. That tells me that this object was a meter across in reality, but the magnification is only 0.16. It's much smaller. This is actually very useful for us because Van Eyck, with the properties of the lens I've calculated, can get the entire chandelier in focus. He doesn't have to refocus. He doesn't focus on the front and then have to refocus to get the back. Made his life easier and makes my analysis much, much easier to do. So we will put blue dots at the top of every candle holder, draw different colored lines through the arcs, and I'm not going to use these arcs today. That's a perfect perspective-corrected hexagon rotated by 4 degrees. Let me now correct for perspective the chandelier. Wow, that looks pretty amazing. And again, for lack of time, I'll ignore the bottom ones, but this is what this looks like when I magnify it. It doesn't fit a perfect hexagon. Worst case, we're off here by 6 centimeters. 2 inches. Chandelier, it's a meter across. What I'm telling you is this arm is like 2 inches closer to you than it should have been if it were absolutely perfect. Well, you can't see that. If I put the core of the chandelier to the correct scale, put the arms on it, that's where they should have been if it were in perfect perspective. I'll draw a outline at the radius of the circle. Big brass arm. Well, you can imagine it's easy to move it this direction, to solder it to the mount incorrectly by this amount, but it's not easy to bend it out. So let me just kind of rotate these around, keeping the lengths fixed. That one should have been there. Move these. Take away all the visual clutter. If you were the Arnold Fini's dog and you looked up, this is what you would have seen, and you would have said to yourself, looks pretty good. Don't object to this chandelier. Doesn't look like it's bad. There's my Home Depot chandelier. I do the same analysis, and notice, this chandelier that you'll go spend your good money for today to purchase, in fact, is as imperfect as the Arnold Fini chandelier. And the moral of that story is, well, of course, if your eye isn't sensitive to those kind of deviations, you can have a mass-produced, machine-produced chandelier that certainly looks good enough for you to spend your $100 on. But it's not perfect. And we draw horizon lines. The Van Eyck is no worse than this. Another aspect of three-dimensional objects, got to remind you, there's no way you would know from this two-dimensional representation that the original three-dimensional object looked like that. Information is lost when you go from 3D to 2D. We have to look for the right kind of information for us to analyze since we've lost some of the information. Again, now, I'll take all the chandelier arms, outline them all in color, take away the chandelier, flop those to the other side by 180 degrees so I can overlap them, and I'll overlap them. Looks like I got a huge mess. Let me correct for perspective. Whoa, look at that. All these arcs of all these arms, the ones that are facing toward you, sideways, back, all agree to a couple of percent. He did that by eyeball? I don't think so. And separately, I showed you, completely separate kind of analysis, I showed you that the tips of the candle holders, here shown here, were based on optical projections. This kind of analysis that we did, each individual arm is two-dimensional, although the overall structure is three-dimensional. So we've done the analysis. What allowed us to do the analysis was breaking it down into a series of 2D analysis that we could do in order to reconstruct information from the 3D chandelier. So in the end, we said these are optical features. These are the arms of the decorative features were hand-attached, individually attached. They're non-optical features. Van Eyck may have chosen deliberately to move these features. So part is, and again, I'll just say when we go through this, there's all sorts of evidence that we get from this particular painting that Van Eyck used optics. Different kind of evidence now. I'm showing you kind of bits and pieces of different kinds of evidence as we go through here. This is Cardinal Albergati. So we've seen him before. Seems to me this guy is hiding something from us. And if we ask him just right, he might be willing to tell us. So let's see if he is. Here's the painting of Cardinal Albergati. There's the drawing. And I've reproduced them to the correct relative scale. The painting is 40% larger than the drawing. This is a rare example from this period where a drawing and a painting have survived together. How did Van Eyck make this painting such an accurate reproduction of the drawing? To me, by the time I discovered this sort of, after I'd been working with David for some months, and I found these side-by-side in an art history book, I mean, it looks as if he took that painting, put it on a reducing photocopy machine, hit 40%, and got that. Let's see how accurate it is. I'll magnify them to the same relative size. Looks really good. I'll make this one semi-transparent, and I'll overlay them. Whoa. Well, first, we'll come back to the ear in a minute. So ignore the ear for the moment. Let's look at this. We see that there are certain features. The collar is off, the ear is off. But certain features, like in the center of the face, if I magnify that, I'm taking a little portrait, and I've magnified a portion of a portrait to 15 feet across, that's 1 millimeter. Every eyelash, every wrinkle, everything lines up to sub-millimeter accuracy. How did Van Eyck do that? Either he was a human pantograph, being able to blow up something by 40%. By the way, the pantograph wasn't invented for another 100 years. Or optics. And I'll show you it was optics. I'll put that back in. And we've got this problem with the ear. So to set the stage for this story, Cardinal Albergati visited Bruges in 3 days in December in, I don't know, 14-something, 1432. Northern Europe, not unlike northern Illinois, in winter, there is no sunlight. And northern Europe is further north. If Van Eyck had put him in his standard posing, and presumably the cardinal wanted a painting this big, and he paid for a painting this big, you put put the cardinal in that position, try to project his image with dim sunlight, the image is too dim to work with. If you make the image half the size, you make it four times as bright, and it's workable. So I can visualize Van Eyck scrambling around, trying to project the image of Cardinal Albergati to finally get this, but it's 40% too small for the painting. Now, these were not times. It's not like you paint it, if you get paid for a painting this big from an important cardinal, you don't send him a painting this big. Bad thing to do. Bad career move. So now he's forced to figure out how to solve this. Well, you think about it for a minute. If you now put this painting in exactly, or this drawing, in exactly the optical setup you used for the original painting, you could magnify it. But this is what you would have seen when you did that. Again, now we're projecting an image to be 40% larger, more than life size. At best, we can assume a simple lens would give us some small region of the painting that's in reasonably good focus. Let's see what we can do with this, though. We'll mark in the features we can use. This can't even see the ear. We'll just translate it sideways. No, this is in focus. Looks good. We'll fill that in. Fill that part in. Now we've succeeded in making the thing 40% larger. There's our final painting. We'll fill in the color, and this is the painting, and this is how we got each individual region to sub-millimeter accuracy, but he got features that are bumped by 4 millimeters or so. High precision, low accuracy. And this is, optics explains this perfectly. Then the final example I'm going to show you, in this painting, there's all sorts of stuff in this painting, actually, we've extracted information from, but I want to focus your attention on, what's that smear there across the front? Well, if we rotate this, ooh, it's a skull. Why did he do that? We were not going to address that question. How did he do that? This has been known for hundreds of years that skull was there. It's been assumed it was done in some kind of geometrical fashion. I'm sure it was done with optics. If I take the skull and I put it back into the painting, it's not a very good-looking skull, in fact. If you think about this, the jaw is too long. There's a bulge back here. In his right eye, it's got this evil, sinister look. Can optics explain this for us? There's Holbein's skull. There's a real skull. Well, I'll try to reproduce the setup. Put a skull, there's my concave mirror, and what I'm going to do is reflect and focus. If you have a circle here, it'll be stretched into an ellipse there. I'll make my anamorphic skull. Then all it remains for me to do is photograph it and show you the result. If I show you the setup, when I take the mirror out of my ring stand, this is taken from exactly the point of view of the concave mirror. So you would think, after I've stretched this and shrunk it and messed with it, when I'm all done, I may have sort of degraded the image, but I will reproduce this skull. No, because when you try to project it, immediately you discover this is what you get because of the depth of field. Well, let's see if we can use something here. We'll fill in the part we can see that's in focus, so the rest of our canvas is still blank. Move the lens a little bit to refocus further into the painting. Oh, I used the wrong version here. I'm sorry. I meant to reveal this more slowly. And we piece this together in segments. Now I'll rotate it vertically, compress it. Something's wrong. Jaw's too long. Bulge back here. Sinister right eye. I swear we've seen that before. And we've seen it there. Now we'll go further. You can see where he's even made a mistake. When he refocused, he accidentally duplicated this region. Real easy thing to do. If you take away the duplicated section, this is what he should have painted. And for the mathematically literate in the audience, I want to point out the magnification in such an image is linear in the vertical direction, but it varies as 1 over sine theta in the horizontal direction, and it's piecewise segmented. The only way he could have constructed this geometrically is if he'd understood how to do a piecewise segmented nonlinear transformation, which I sort of doubt, or he simply used a lens. And the other alternative is, if you photograph the actual skull from a grazing angle, if he had a skull that was of this shape, and I'll leave this as a homework assignment for you guys, if the skull he worked with was this shape, he could have created this skull geometrically. So I have to assume there are no people running around that look like this, even though it was almost the Middle Ages. So to summarize, I've shown you just a small piece of the overwhelming scientific evidence that lenses were used as early as 1425. And can I emphasize, these are not photographs. They're more complicated than photographs. Portions of these are photographically based or optically based. Portions are not. The artist made all sorts of decisions. If we go back to the Arnolfini marriage painting, the woman is in a green dress. For all we know, she was in a purple dress, a purple paisley tie-dye dress at the time. And Van Eyck thought, that's really tasteless. She's not going to like this when she grows up. It's going to be like parents showing their kids pictures of you wearing bell-bottoms. So he wasn't going to let that happen, and he painted her in a different color. So the artist still is responsible for the composition, the color, the elements to put into the painting. The lens produces the image for you. The artist has to decide how to use them. Now, where I can show you a lens was used and show you exactly the image that was in front of the artist and show you the artist didn't use that image. He made modifications. That's insight into the thought process of a major artist who died 600 years ago. Science lets us ask questions no one even would have thought of asking before this. We can ask questions, what was the artist thinking? Why did he make that aesthetic choice? It's actually pretty amazing that we can do this now, thanks to understanding the science behind these. And it really does fundamentally affect our understanding of the art of the past 600 years. Here's a quote from an art historian. This genre, the complexity of the portrait, just happened suddenly in a time scale. People have known this, have studied this, have not understood why. We now understand why. It was optics.
Here's what's so revolutionary about what you're saying. You're saying the history of art, the history of the Renaissance, is the history
That's
of
David,
optics.
I am saying
I know that, yeah. And you're blowing everything up. You're blowing everything that all of us who took art appreciation studied, all the art historians have written, and you're saying you're all wrong. It's all about optics.
This has not made us popular with art historians. So with this, I will quit. Sorry, I spoke slower than I normally do because I was afraid I'd lose my voice if I covered it. Yes, go ahead. Okay. Oh, he gets the mic first. Okay.
So, until when do you have evidences of use of lenses in art? For example, later painters, Caravaggio, I don't know, Rembrandt. Do you have evidences there?
Okay, so the person with the Italian accent asked me about Caravaggio. So, in fact, when do we have evidence? The first evidence we have is like 1425, and then continuously from 1425 with name brand artists, Bellini, Caravaggio, Vermeer, all the way up to 2006, Chuck Close, lenses have been used. There was never a time that they weren't used. Yes, we have evidence that Caravaggio used lenses. Or projected images. They could have been concave mirrors, but projected images.
So this is related. Do you have an idea of the geographic diffusion?
Geographic diffusion, that's an interesting one too. That how fast did this diffuse? Where did it diffuse first? The first painter outside of Flanders that I found evidence that he used optics is a Spanish painter whose name is Juan de Flandres, Juan of Flanders. And so we see the diffusion in Holland and Spain, thanks to the monarchy, were intimately tied at the time. We see the first evidence in Italy a little bit later, but the Italians were painting with plaster. The Northern Europeans were painting with oil paint. With plaster, it's kind of a projected image is helpful for you. Once they came on to oil paint, then we see the Bellinis and the Montaignas taking on optics.
Can I ask, didn't anybody write a manual for, you know, this where they said lenses could be used, you know, as an instruction manual for artists, or what is it considered a trade secret of some sort?
Okay, so the trade secret problem. In fact, no one has found where somebody's written this down, but it was really if it was a secret, it was a poorly kept secret, because the first two artists that I can show optics were used were one, Robert Campan, and Jan van Eyck. So I showed you both of those. They were contemporaries. They are known to have known each other. They're documented to have visited each other. They live 15 miles apart, a day's horse ride apart. The next three painters I can show you used optics were Petrus Christus, Hans Memling, and Rogier van der Weyden. These three were apprentices of those two. So the knowledge diffused out very rapidly. But these guys, their job wasn't to write a FizRev letter. Their job was to create wealth for themselves. So I can easily imagine if I were Van Eyck and I'm getting all these commissions and I'm one of the wealthiest people in Bruges and you come to me and ask me how I do this, well, what I'm going to tell you is I'm just better than you. Why would I tell you? You know, so, but no one has found anything in writing. The evidence is all in the images. You have to understand the images.
But why would the practice stop? Because you've chosen a very specific period in art history, and then you really haven't shown me anything that's sort of in the intermediate period before we then get to Chuck Close. So why does the practice stop?
Well, the practice doesn't stop, but the lecture stops after 50 minutes. And so, I mean, I'm really being serious. I could go on for, I have enough evidence to talk for 8 hours. And all the way through Vermeer and Angra and the like. So it never stops. But my premise is, in all this, is if I show you the earliest place where they used optics, that everyone later is suspect. So I've always been pushing to the earliest. And so what I've tried to do here is show you some of the earliest evidence rather than picking later stuff. But I have lots of evidence from lots of people later in the 8-hour version of my lecture.
Sorry, you made a comment up here on the left. You made a comment about the parameters of the lenses coming out close to each other, and that gave you some comfort. But do you have any reason to not suspect more variation just from people trying different things or people doing a bad job of this than you've actually seen?
So it turns out that it's like a bigger lens is better, a bigger concave mirror is better because, of course, the brightness scales as the square of the diameter. So get brighter images if we make something bigger. Unfortunately, the astigmatism and the spherical aberration scale is the fourth power of the diameter. So it gets fuzzier faster than it gets brighter. And effectively, the sweet spot ends up being about an inch or two where you get an image that is high enough resolution that it's usable and bright enough that it's usable, but the aberrations haven't killed you. And I also should say that not in very many cases can I actually extract quantitative information that of to the extent at which I did for that Lorenzo Lotto. If he had painted a floral pattern tablecloth rug, I couldn't have extracted the information. The fact it was a regular geometric structure is what allowed me to do it. So there are lots of paintings I've looked at, and I say, you know, this has got every signature that optics were used, but I can't show that optics were used because there isn't enough information of the right kind.
You say it's a trade secret sort of thing. Does that imply that the people that were being painted didn't realize that this was happening, the portraits were being made of?
Yeah, so why didn't the person being painted realize this? The optical situation... I showed you the David Hockney painting his friend dressed up as Cardinal Albergati. He was out in the sunlight, the patron. David was inside behind a window, and the guy's image was projected on the inside wall. If you think about it, the distance from the subject to the lens has to be greater than from the lens to the canvas in order to have a magnification less than unity. By definition, he can't see the image being projected. The subject can't even see it. Why didn't he write about the concave mirror? A concave mirror that's an inch or so in diameter that has a 1 meter focal length is essentially flat. If you saw these things, I mean, they're scratched, they're brass, they're totally nondescript. You wouldn't have any reason to suspect they could do anything. If you walk around to the other side and you see the projected image, you go, you're stunned. So the mirror itself, the concave mirror, is just not remarkable in the least. Let's say in spite of that, you're a patron and you saw this. Would have required you to go home and write in your diary in Flemish in 1425, today Charlie Falco painted my painting, and he had this funny object on the wall behind him. And, you know, it was kind of brass looking, and I'm not quite sure what it was, but kind of scratched. And I was very curious. Your diary would have had to survive for 600 years. A historian would have to have found your diary, who reads Flemish, read this, and then go, oh, scratched up brass object, not sure what it is, that must have been a concave mirror. It just isn't going to happen. So there's every reason why, even if it's not even, you know, a secret of the kind you're trying to keep, it just isn't something that's written down.
Okay, why don't we take one more question here?
Okay, so my question is probably a bit unusual, but I appreciate you setting the record straight on this, because 3 years ago I heard a colloquium at the University of Washington where someone used the exact same paintings to show that this was actually not the case. And I was wondering how often you come across someone like me where you have to actually demonstrate where optics was used to an audience who had actually heard otherwise to begin with.
Well, if I know, I mean, I'm going to guess who gave that colloquium. The data in there were not, to phrase it, were inaccurate. Were systematically inaccurate. Totally, all the data that that person used were incorrect. And you'll be reading more about that at some point in the not too distant future.
Okay, let's thank the speaker one more time.